the government has pulled away the ability for the average people to make a lot of different kinds of investments. The SEC basically blocks all kinds of different opportunities because they, you know, they scrutinize everything, right? So that's why we have the world we live in where institutional money like VC money has access to all these tech companies, grows them to tens of billions of dollars of value, only then give put them out on the IPO because it's just not worth for these companies to go public anymore.
What's up?
How you doing?
Well, you know, it took me 20 minutes to log into this because technology decided that it just didn't want to work. So I'm good, coming in hot. Got my summer shirt on here, the tie dye. So I'm ready to roll for some warm weather.
What's on your mind today? What do you want to talk about?
Oh man, I had a bunch of stuff on my list, and we've got a really cool guest coming in to jam on some stuff. So I would suggest we just dive right into it. There was a bunch of interesting stuff that happened recently, much of which I think is sort of evergreen. So I'd love to jam on some of it. First thing on my list? Did you see this this whole thing that happened with Ross Ulbricht, the Silk Road guy, and this like Bitcoin finding?
I did.
So for people that don't know who this is, Ross Ulbricht, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, Ulbricht, he was the founder of Silk Road, which was, for lack of a better way to put it, like Amazon for illegal stuff. You know, it was founded in, 2011. It was like you would use the Tor like anonymous browser, so you could use it anonymously. And it was founded with like really kind of libertarian ideals, and it was basically the first use case of Bitcoin, like in the very early days. And it's part of the reason why like Bitcoin got a reputation as being a currency for like scammers and fraudsters and, you know, illegal kind of grifters, because it was basically being used on Silk Road to purchase all variety of things. The vast majority, I think, of Silk Road, maybe you saw it way back in the day, was like kind of harmless drugs. Like I think a lot of people were buying weed that I knew like on Silk Road and other like party drugs. But then, you know, there was, it's the internet, so there was like dark parts of Silk Road that were people buying, you know, all sorts of things, guns, you know, more harmful drugs, etc. But you know, Ross Ulbricht was the founder of it. He was like the Jeff Bezos of this Silk Road thing. There was a huge bust in 2013 when they found it. And he basically got charged with all variety of crimes, despite the fact that it was a platform that he was running, right? Like it kind of, the whole case basically said that he was selling these things rather than like operating the platform. And he got sentenced to life without parole. And it's like this very, very controversial case.
Yeah. So I remember going on the Silk Road and just testing it out, you know, as a good product person, I got to test everything out. One of the things, I mean, there was a bunch of harmless stuff, but there was also some crazy things on the Silk Road. So there was like, I remember like a whole guide around how to break into an ATM machine. So
that you could buy, like you could buy the guide.
It was basically like this guy, he was like, I've broken into
many
ATM machines, and I'm like the guy, you know. And if you want to be like me, all you have to do for the, you know, low price of one Bitcoin, you can do this too.
If you're anything like me, your portfolio is a mix of the usual suspects: stocks, bonds, and mutual funds. Maybe you've even dabbled in some alternative assets like crypto, but those investments can be incredibly unpredictable. You know what typically isn't unpredictable? Apartment buildings, rental homes, industrial facilities, places we go every day to work, eat, and live. That's all private real estate. And thanks to its historical stability, as well as its reputation as a reliable income stream, these investments could be a valuable addition to your portfolio. This is where Fundrise comes in. Fundrise is changing the game when it comes to real estate investing and making this powerful asset class easily available to investors like you and me. Their easy-to-use app lets you build a real estate portfolio tailored to meet your goals. It's a great way to benefit from real estate's many perks while adding some much-needed diversification to your portfolio. So join over 250,000 other investors building a better portfolio with private real estate. Signing up is easy. Just head over to fundrise.com/room. Again, that's FUNDRISE.com/room to get started today. Today, I am so excited to talk about Riverside. Riverside is the leading platform for studio quality remote podcasts and video recordings from anywhere. We absolutely love it at Where It Happens, and you're going to love it too. Greg, what have you enjoyed most about Riverside?
What's amazing about Riverside is that when you're recording a remote video podcast or a remote interview, the recording quality is independent of Wi-Fi stability. It basically records locally, which is a huge advantage in order to ensure a reliable and uncompressed content outcome. The way I think about it, it's basically like a studio inside your browser. And it's not just us who uses it. It's 70,000 plus people ranging from Guy Raz, Gary Vee, and the New York Times.
It's an amazing experience, super easy and intuitive to use. You don't need a whole team on the back end to manage it, to get it up onto all of the podcasting platforms. It is just a great overall experience, truly a podcast studio in your pocket that you can use from anywhere. We absolutely love it, and you're going to as well. So to check out Riverside, go to riverside.fm and use code HAPPENS for 15% off a membership plan. Again, that's riverside.fm. And use code HAPPENS for 15% off at checkout. Yeah, it's like, it's, I mean, it's funny because, like, it's like the illegal alternative to like Gumroad. Like, that same guy sells that book on Gumroad as like an ebook, how to break into ATM machines, but, you know, was doing it there. The crazy thing about the case, and there's an amazing book on it if anyone hasn't read it called American Kingpin, which I don't know if they've done it yet, but it would be an incredible movie because the story of the rise of the Silk Road and what he was like going through the lengths to try to not get caught. Because basically, like, the acceleration of it was like any insane tech company story, but it was not venture backed. It was just like pure product market fit insanity. And the growth and the amount of Bitcoin that was flowing through the ecosystem and the amount of money he was making, like, he was operating under the pseudonymous name Dread Pirate Roberts, which was the fictional character from The Princess Bride. And it was just like, I think it astounded him and he probably got completely off guard by it, but it was like insane product market fit and product led growth story. And then basically, you know, he gets taken down in this bust and it becomes, you know, as part of it, right, they like kind of indicted him on a bunch of different things. One of the things he got indicted for was like 6 or 7 murders that he allegedly ordered and paid for, none of which were actually carried out, but that it was alleged that he had kind of solicited murder for hire. And he didn't get charged with it ultimately. And he didn't get tried for it. Like, they didn't convict him of those things. And so his sentencing has been a massive dispute, especially for libertarians who argue that, like, he was running a platform. If people were doing illegal things on it, not really his fault. He should be kind of absolved of that. And for people who are like, look, you can, you know, say that he did those things, but if you didn't get convicted of those things or charged with those things, the murders, how is he sentenced to life without the possibility of parole for what amounts to like a bunch of, you know, kind of like drug trafficking charges effectively? So there's this massive crusade that has continued and that a lot of like big tech Illuminati type figures are behind to try to free Ross, basically. The reason it's back in the news, which is what I was referencing before, is because part of his whole deal was that he had to pay like $193 million of restitution to the US government for, like, basically they were charging him like a fine for every single transaction that went through the Silk Road over the years that he operated it. And so he owed $193 million. So even if he gets released and somehow like the crusade works and he gets out, he was going to be $193 million in debt to the US government, basically never a free man. All of his wages would be garnished, etc. Now that has changed because the US government has like basically secretly signed a deal with him that this $1 billion bounty that they have found from a hack of the Silk Road, they are crediting towards his debts to the US government. And so he has now effectively paid back the debts to the US government of $193 million.
It's unbelievable. I remember reading that and I was like, this guy, man, this guy.
I mean, it's like a completely insane story. The fact that it's not a movie yet, actually, like, it's going to be an incredible, whoever makes it, it's going to be an incredible movie. And I think part of it is, like, people have wanted the story to finish because there's some, I think there's, like, a broad case to be made that that he will get out at some point. Maybe then they will try to charge him with, you know, the alleged murders and bring him up on that, which is a totally separate thing. But the whole story is, like, completely remarkable. And the book, if no one has read it, the book is incredible. American Kingpin is what it's called. We'll throw it in the show notes. So anyway, I wanted to start off with that because I think it's a fascinating story. It's also ties to, like, crypto, Bitcoin, and the early days of the actual use cases of all of this.
Let me shift gears a little bit with something that's on my mind.
Hit me.
So last week was Miami Tech Week. I live in Miami. So basically, it's this new, for those of you who don't know, it's like this new holiday, tech holiday, that Delian from Founders Fund, who's a VC, basically a year and a half ago, I think he created this, and it was like a small event last year. This year, like, it was huge. Like, every major fund was throwing events. It felt very much like a mini South by Southwest. And what I wanted to talk about and what's been on my mind is a tweet that I saw from a buddy of mine, Furkan, who said, "Your product doesn't get built at conferences and growth doesn't happen at networking events. If you're a founder, I highly suggest skipping these events. The real work happens at a keyboard." And I was reflecting on that a bit because I spend so much like energy, just like personal energy, talking to people, like Ubering here, Ubering there, going to this dinner, doing this, doing that. And I definitely agree with him that, like, I think that for, if you're a founder, now I'm not saying like, if, you know, if you're a VP sales, if you're a director of biz dev, if you're like, you know, chief marketing officer, like, yes, like maybe go to those events. But if you're a founder, I think the most efficient way to spend your time is behind the keyboard. What do you think?
I go both ways on this, right? I think it's tough because my general perspective is like, one side of me says that these are the type of things where you end up getting lucky. Like, you go to something like this, there's 10,000 people in Miami, you know, half of whom are like very smart, interested in similar things to you. You go to these events, you mingle, new ideas strike, insight strikes, you meet someone that you wouldn't have otherwise met, good things happen. And if it's like 2-3 days, you cannot build for a couple days. Like, what did you do last weekend? You took a day off, maybe, whatever. So that's like one side of me. The other side of me says, yeah, like, you know, in the early days of something, you have to put your damn head down because otherwise, you know, you're just not going to make that early traction in order to get something done. I guess my general take, kind of putting it all into a blender, is like, what type of founder are you? Because I think there are founders who, they're not the builder, right? Like, they're the salesman. And to use the Naval thing, which is one of my favorite general frameworks around this, you either need to learn how to build or you need to learn how to sell. And someone that can do both is completely unstoppable. And there's like probably a handful of people who can do both at an elite level, like a Elon Musk or like a Steve Jobs or whatever. Those are like insanely elite individuals. They can build and sell. But for the most part, people can either do one or the other. And so if you're like in the build camp, if you're an engineer and you're a builder, yeah, I agree. Like, you probably should put your head down and be behind the keyboard. But if you're a sell type and what you're really exceptional at is selling, going to one of these events and like selling the dream of your idea, that can be the difference between like having Keith Raboy, you know, Founders Fund meet you, see you, you know, the new investor comes on, like a new employee that could be your 10x engineer that you happen to meet there. Like, if you're out there selling in that environment, maybe that's what's actually the best use of your time, not sitting behind a keyboard.
Yeah, my take on it, and you'll get this because, I mean, we'll both get this. We both spend a lot of time on Twitter and blogging and stuff like that. My thinking is, if I could spend 72 hours behind a keyboard typing an amazing like blog post or email newsletter or an epic Twitter thread, the like, if that goes viral and millions of people see that, it's just way more efficient use of time. Now, I still love going to these events and I love hanging out with, like, I got this, like, I treat it as like a vacation, you know what I mean? Like, I ran into so many amazing friends, and it was really fun. And I did hit, you know, play the slot machine a little bit, and I did meet some really cool people, which could be like lifelong friendships, which is awesome and good for my business. But I still think if I'm looking at it just from an efficiency standpoint, heads down for me is the way to go.
I think you're probably right. I mean, I think, and it depends what stage you're at, right? Like, you and I aren't in the trenches building something like a product today. And so a big part of your job, like what you're doing and, you know, what I'm doing too, is being out. And so it is like, that's probably the most efficient use of our time relative to a builder who's kind of like in the trenches today. And they probably should spend that time doing, you know, doing building or creative work or something that's going to reach, you know, have like a much more scalable reach overall. So I don't know. I can go both ways on it. But I do think it's a really interesting discussion point. I saw the like back and forth on Twitter of different people arguing over whether founders should go to these type of events. And I thought it was interesting. But like, just to say it, the Web3 space in general, I think has skewed too far to the sell and not enough to the build. So I think it's like a good call to arms in general to like throw a shot across the bow to the general industry of like, you know, there's so many of these companies that are raising at absurd prices off of no product. And it's because they're incredible salesmen and there's like this unbelievable heat around the market. And I think it needs to come back into some level of balance.
We got Val in the waiting room, so should we bring...
What is up?
What's going on, guys?
Hey, what's going on, man?
All good.
Good to have you.
Yeah, man. We got the two legends over here. It's awesome.
Three legends, man. I appreciate you joining. You're crushing it. We're excited to have you and excited to hear more about your story and dive into some hopefully cool ideas.
Yeah, absolutely, man.
Can you just give us the, like, 1 minute version of your background? And it doesn't actually have to be 1 minute, but just so like all of our listeners understand why you are so legit, don't give us the humble version either. Like, I want the real version of some of the shit that you've done.
So we're live,
man.
All right, man, you're going straight to the point here.
Well, we've already been on for like 20 minutes before you, so we're all like warmed up and ready to roll. All
right, man. Well, I don't even get to see your hair today. That's not right.
You're here for the hair and you don't even get to see it.
So I'm just here for the hair.
I'm rocking the St. Woods hat today.
Oh yeah, it looks good.
But Greg got like starting to get that going on. So I don't know, man. You guys got a nice competition on that front going. Yeah, man, listen, I built I'm an immigrant, came to this country when I was like 11. And I got my computer only like at 16 years old. By that point, I already knew everything about computers. And I was just so hungry, launched a company. I just started like doing some stuff and it just kind of took off. Came across, I mean, there was like a bunch of steps, but I built, at like 19, I started a company that built, did Google advertising and like I essentially crushed it, like just huge arbitrage. Did it all by myself out of my parents' basement. And then like I lived in a suburbia just to like for tax purposes and people thought I was a drug dealer in the neighborhood.
This is one of my favorite stories about you, by the way, is just like Val basically became a whale of like Google advertising business. Like you were like the second biggest buyer of AdWords or something from your parents' basement.
Yeah, basically.
Val, it was like you and like eBay.
Like, what were you doing? Like, affiliate? Like, what were you doing?
Yeah, I was doing a lot of affiliate stuff. I had like 800 different advertisers that I was marketing. You know, I was an affiliate marketer, but I had a lot of like very premium deals, a lot of like nice brands. So I was definitely like on the premium side of affiliate marketing. If you could, you know, so like my clients were like New York Times and Rhapsody and eBay themselves, and so it was like I did all the good stuff, and it, you know, I didn't really do colon cleansers and Acai-Berry stuff, you know, and all those interesting things that were out.
What year was this in?
So I started around right after like the .com bubble collapse.
Okay, so
it wasn't actually Google I started with. I started back in the days when it used to be Overture, which became GoTo.com, and then was acquired by Yahoo, which became Yahoo Search. So I was big on Yahoo first.
This was an epic. So no one talks about this, but from 2000 to 2006 was the heyday of affiliate marketing. Yeah. And for those of you who don't know what affiliate marketing is it's basically when a brand, instead of going out and doing their own advertising, they say, hey, Sahil, we'll give you $5 for every install or lead or sale that you generate. And they give you a special Sahil code. When people think of affiliate marketing today, they actually think of it as like influencer marketing. What was happening from 2000 to 2006 is there were people like you, Val, and I actually was also involved in some of this, where we would do arbitrage. So we would actually, you would go, let's just say, and do a deal with eHarmony.com. eHarmony.com would pay you $5 for every lead. And you would go, and because at the time, these big brands were terrible at user acquisition, it was completely brand new. These people, and they call them super affiliates, these super affiliates were better at marketing than some of these big brands.
I mean, it's completely... Yeah, basically. So you were basically... but you didn't know how to do this. It's not like you like went to school for this or something. You were basically just kind of like hustling in the early days. You were like, oh yeah, I can do it for this price. And you'd go, you know, learn how to do it, scale it up. And then once you had done it well, you were like, oh, I can scale this up, do it with more money, bigger brands, whatever.
Yeah. I mean, listen, I had a bullshit like little PlayStation website and it started making like $5,000 a month. I was in high school, which is a lot of money in the 90s. Right away, dot-com bubble burst. And like, I went from making $5,000 a month to like $500 a month. Actually, that was revenue. So I was probably losing it after all the web hosting costs and all that. So I started like scrambling to figure out how to sell advertising. So I started selling advertising on my own. Then I realized that like, wow, I'm actually pretty good. Like I need more inventory. So I started selling advertising on other people's websites. And then I started looking for more ways to like scale that up. So that's kind of how I came across affiliate marketing, because I just grabbed a few like deals from half.com at the time, because they would have video games. The video games was a big category there. So I was like, wow, this is actually kind of converting. And that led to me testing it on search. I lost money. Like I lost $6,000, I think, actually, the first night. I turned it on GoTo.com. There were no budget caps at the time. I go to sleep, I wake up, I'm negative $6,000. And like, I only had $1,000 in leads. So I lost like 5 G's that one night, right? I was like, holy cow. I think most people will actually say, oh my God, I'm never doing this again. Like the stupidest thing ever. And I just, something just like on the inside, I just had that gut feeling. Wait, I made I brought in $1,000, right? Like sometimes it's like I'm an optimist. Right. So I look at it, it's like, wow, I brought in $1,000. I didn't think of it like, hey, I lost $5,000. Right. So like I was able to take that $1,000 and then see like just dive into that $1,000 that we were able to generate and turn that into a gold mine. I mean that just
what did you end up making over those few years? Like before, you know, the market now, it's funny, right? Like this market has become hyper efficient now, or at least much more efficient because of how much. I mean, you were sort of like a pioneer, right? Like you were early days, so there was massive spreads. Like you could, you could make a ton of money off of doing this. Now there's like so much money across all of this stuff that has flown in, and so it's made the market more efficient. But like, just to give people a sense of the scope, you were 19 years old when you started this and built this out of the basement. Like, what did you end up making off this from a profit standpoint?
Over 30 million.
out of your parents' basement.
Yeah.
That's so absurd. I remember reading your, you wrote a piece about it, which I remember reading, I don't know, 6 months ago or something like that, that just said that like at your largest, you were Google's second largest advertiser as well, like operating out of your parents' basement, which is just like, that's one of my favorite things ever.
Yeah, and the funny thing is I only found out because somebody told me that from the inside. And then when Google had like all these class action lawsuits, I realized how big of a percentage I was of that class action. Now, they didn't file it. It's like somebody obviously else did all the work. My numbers were pretty big and like on that. So I was like, wow, I didn't realize how big of a chunk of the revenue I was at one point. And this is like probably right around right before their IPO. So they were like already big, but not that big yet.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you're right. Listen, man, the markets are becoming way more efficient. And the way I look at it is the windows of opportunities are starting to get shorter and shorter. So like you're talking about 2000, 2006, whether it's affiliate market or really search. Like I look at it more on the search side, right? That had like a nice six-year window. Mm-hmm. But after that, the display advertising also had a decent window. But everything after that, like Facebook, I mean, it probably got closed in 2 years, right? Instagram, 1 year. Like TikTok has probably got burned out like within a year, right? And if you could catch that lightning bolt, right, in that short opportunity window of opportunity, and you could build up on that. That's the magic, because there are plenty of successful people still on TikTok, right? A lot of them kind of caught that wave early on when it was an open opportunity.
Yeah, that's really profound, because I think what you're saying is the half-life of marketing channels are getting shorter and shorter, especially with all these tools. Like now, like when you create a Facebook ad, it's out in the open. Your competitors can go and check your Facebook ad, and vice versa. You can go and check their Facebook ad. So I think I remember, well, I sound like an old person, but I remember when you can buy a Facebook ad for a nickel.
Back in my day.
You literally, when the Facebook ad platform came out, it was a nickel for a click.
Yeah, especially for content.
Yes. They were charging 5 cents. Like for content.
Like going to the movies for our parents.
Like I don't know the average right now, but it's, 50 cents to $1.50. So the Facebook ad platform comes out with all this inventory. It's 5 cents. And we looked at it, and I was also young at the time. This is like, what year was that, Val? Like 2006, maybe 2007, when they did their ad platform, something like that.
Facebook,
yeah.
No, they were later than that.
Yeah, it had to have been later than that, because it would have been. I was like out of high school. Yeah,
it must have been like 2011 or something. I don't know.
Let's see. I don't.
And does it work as an
2007?
Like,
November 2007.
They just put it out, and then people bid on it.
Yeah, so they put it out, people bid on it, it's 2007. How old am I at this time? I'm 18 years old, 17 or 18 years old. And what we did was did deals with the Zyngas of the world, who are building Facebook games, who needed installs. So they would pay us $3.50 for all these social game companies for every installs, and we were buying clicks for 5 cents.
So you were an install super affiliate.
Yeah. So we like our niche, like we understood community and social. So when all these social networks started implementing ad platforms, we were really good at creating content around it. So then we're just like, oh, hey, let's just do a deal with, and I don't speak about this publicly very much, by the way, Sahil. I see your face. You're like, what? I don't even know you. But like the beauty about affiliate marketing is that if you get this to work and it costs you 50 cents and you get $1.50 out, you want to, instead of putting $1,000 a day, you want to put $10,000 a day or $100,000 a day or $1 million a day. And it becomes the world's greatest money vending machine.
Yeah. It's so easy to scale once you got that formula going.
Yeah.
I just remember seeing, I think it was Toby recently that like at Shopify said, like, it's so interesting to your point on like the half-life of these opportunities shrinking over time. It's sort of broadly, by the way, like the half-life of these marketing channel opportunities has definitely shrunk. The half-life of like every opportunity, I feel like, has shrunk with the rise of technology. Like if you have an idea and it looks like an interesting opportunity, you have to go get it fast. Because if you don't, there's someone else that's going to go capitalize on it. It's going to get squeezed out. But like,
there are way more people now, right? Like, that have interest in these spaces.
Yeah, there's more people with the internet, right? There's more people with the internet. Like, it's really hard, right? You're competing not just against like the nerds, with computers, like it might have been 20, 30 years ago. Now it's like everyone has a computer with their phone. Not to mention that like the entire subcontinent of India has come online and is all technology focused. So there's just like there's massive opportunities still, but they go away fast. And so you have to like be a type of person, like you guys both are clearly, to go and capitalize on these things.
Yeah. You know, that said, there's still a lot of fragmentation out there that if you have that skill to do arbitrage, or you actually like doing it, or you have a skill at any particular topic or category, you could still do plenty of arbitrage. You just have to get a little more fragmented and figure out how to scale that fragmentation, which is like one, like the company that I'm building now is a lot to do with that. It's a lot more involved, but you know, but the second business that I scaled up right after that was also just a different set of, arbitrage, which is, I got into the whole music category, and that was actually a bigger business than the first one. I was like, the first year I generated over 10 million in net profit.
Jeez.
It started out with just me, but ended up being like seven people. We had like a monopoly on distribution of premium content, specifically started with like ringtones. So if you ever seen like a music site and said like, send this ringtone to your cell, like back in the years, that was me. We had like a half a billion people we were in front of every month. And so it was pretty, you know, so there's a, once you get like a feeling for those inefficiencies, you could take advantage of them across many categories. Like Greg, like I never got involved on the installs game. I know it was huge. I knew it was huge. I never got on it. Yeah, there's like so many different ways you could to make that work.
Well, there's two ways of, like, if you're listening to this and you're like, okay, how can I get involved in something like this? Well, one way is you find a new platform shift. So like search gets really big and ads come out, or TikTok gets really big and their ads come out. You find a new platform and you create a product or partner with someone with a product on that new platform. And the second way is you create a new, you're just really good at content. So you create a new format on that platform. So as an example,
I don't know about you, but I'm not creative. Like Sahil is obviously creative. Like he has somehow, you're like a weird creature where it sounds like I feel like you're creative, yet you're good with numbers, right? I'm not creative.
I've never been called a weird creature before, but I will take that.
Hey man, that's what makes you tick. Like I said, I'm not creative at all. So I cannot put out content on TikTok or anything like that. So yeah, but people figured out different concepts that work on Instagram stories or TikTok.
Well, what do you see today when you look at the landscape as some of the interesting opportunities?
In any category?
Yeah, broadly. Or... like you're saying, you know, you need to be able to kind of identify what are some of those opportunities that might exist. Like if you were looking out and you were, I know you're building something else right now. If you were looking out, like what do you think are some of the spaces that our listeners should be looking at and thinking about building in?
I still think that a lot of the mom and pops, and mom and pops could be different sizes, right? Like you could have mom and pops who are 300,000 revenue. You could have stores that do 2-5 million. You have car dealerships that do 5-10 million, right? So all kinds of ranges of mom and pops. But I think they're still very much behind in many, many categories. And if you could bring them value, right, connect them and make them relevant on whatever platform, whether it's TikTok or Facebook or Instagram, whatever it is, make them relevant on those category and those platforms, there's absolutely an arbitrage there because they're willing to spend money to catch up and because they haven't caught up. So I do that for the jewelry industry. I mean, what I've done is way more advanced because like I'm also vertically integrated the jewelry manufacturing process and doing all the data and marketing for them. So it's way more like advanced. But if I was, if I had smaller investment, if I could make a smaller investment and even if as a side hustle, I mean, that's what I would do. I would just go out there and start helping small fragmented mom and pops. And you know what? I always historically, I've always started with arbitrage first, because once you figure out that there's an arbitrage in something, you could build and scale around that, right? So, so I think it's very important. And once you do that, once you figure out that magic formula that works, then it's up to you whether you want to take VC money or if you're like, maybe not everybody's good at raising money, right? Not everybody has those connections as well.
Yeah. There's like a massive opportunity broadly. You know, if you think of it as like an agency business model, not raising money, like if you're an individual and you're kind of a hustler and you have a builder mentality around these things, you could probably go like in your town and go to the like small, you know, restaurants, shops, et cetera, in the center of your town or, you know, in the local area. I bet if you went and talked to them, about what they're doing around, you know, online advertising or online reviews or, you know, whatever it might be, I bet you could go and like secure a few, you know, monthly retainer type contracts to go and deliver them value. And you could basically say, hey, it's free the first month. I'll prove, you know, the value of doing this. And then we, you know, agree to some sort of contract going forward. And I bet you could spin up, like, if it's just you too, and you're just like paying your living wage, I mean, you could probably spin up like a $50,000 a month business pretty quickly doing that for like a bunch of local mom and pops on like a, you know, few thousand dollar a month type retainer deal for all of them. Today, I am so excited to talk about Riverside. Riverside is the leading platform for studio quality remote podcasts and video recordings from anywhere. We absolutely love it at Where It Happens, and you're going to love it too. Greg, what have you enjoyed most about Riverside?
What's amazing about Riverside is that when you're recording a remote video podcast or a remote interview, the recording quality is independent of Wi-Fi stability. It basically records locally, which is a huge advantage in order to ensure a reliable and uncompressed content outcome. The way I think about it, it's basically like a studio inside your browser. And it's not just us who uses it. It's 70,000 plus people ranging from Guy Raz, Gary Vee, and the New York Times.
It's an amazing experience, super easy and intuitive to use. You don't need a whole team on the back end to manage it, to get it up onto all of the podcasting platforms. It is just a great overall experience, truly a podcast studio in your pocket that you can use from anywhere. We absolutely love it, and you're going to as well. So to check out Riverside, go to riverside.fm and use code HAPPENS for 15% off a membership plan. Again, that's riverside.fm. And use code HAPPENS for 15% off at checkout. If you're anything like me, your portfolio is a mix of the usual suspects: stocks, bonds, and mutual funds. Maybe you've even dabbled in some alternative assets, like crypto. But those investments can be incredibly unpredictable. You know what typically isn't unpredictable? Apartment buildings, rental homes, industrial facilities, places we go every day to work, eat, and live. That's all private real estate. And thanks to its historical stability, as well as its reputation as a reliable income stream, these investments could be a valuable addition to your portfolio. This is where Fundrise comes in. Fundrise is changing the game when it comes to real estate investing and making this powerful asset class easily available to investors like you and me. Their easy-to-use app lets you build a real estate portfolio tailored to meet your goals. It's a great way to benefit from real estate's many perks while adding some much-needed diversification to your portfolio. So join over 250,000 other investors building a better portfolio with private real estate. Signing up is easy. Just head over to fundrise.com/room. Again, that's fundrise.com/room to get started today.
Yeah, absolutely. But you know what I would do is I wouldn't go local, like your own local backyard. I would pick an industry, like one category, and then start getting them, like locally, regionally, even nationally, like go after that one, because then you're going to be very good at one. Mm. So when I was thinking about launching my last company, so I actually retired for like 3 years, right? And I was too bored. I got to like build something myself. And I was like, no, I'm going to go after something that's not corporate America, because that's what I've done my whole life, right? I want to do something that helps the Main Street. And so the things I was looking at is like something very huge, like huge but fragmented. So pizza shops, right? And this is before like Slice came out. I don't know, like later on Slice, I was kind of thinking in that realm, right? I was thinking about all the bars, like all the pubs, they have these like beer dispensing systems, right? Like, why can't I take over that distribution of that, right? And then I own that distribution point. Like that was the stuff I was thinking about. just going very after like one category, but that's very fragmented. So
I love it as like a general framework or idea for starting and building something. You guys want to do some business ideas?
Yeah, sure. Let's hit it.
Let's do it. All right. Well, first off, I want to do one that's sparked by a thread that you did, Val. So I was recently on Twitter, and Greg obviously knows this, but Val, I'm expecting my first child soon. And
awesome.
Little boy, super excited. But you wrote a thread about basically rather than paying your kids allowance, you pay them interest. And it sparked for me a business idea that I think is kind of interesting. But will you just kind of give the general concept of what you wrote about, and then I'll lay out the idea?
Yeah, absolutely. So it all started with my view, again, immigrant mentality, and how do I instill my kids to look, they're going to grow up in a different environment that I grew up. I was never like super poor or anything like that, but I lived in the Soviet Union. And like I said, I couldn't get a computer for the next first 6 years in this country. So, I mean, we had food on our table, but I was never like wealthy or well off or anything like that. So how do I instill that into my kids? And you know, I realized that resourcefulness is very important, right? So I actually don't give, I purposely limit the resources. I throttle the resources they get, right? I want them to figure it out, how to do a lot with very little, right? Essentially, that's what made me successful, I think, right? At least that's what I think. So the idea was, okay, I'm not going to give you an allowance. You're not going to get free money, right? You're going to have to figure out how the world works. And, you know, I noticed they start getting like little birthday gifts and little holiday gifts. And I told them like, hey, and they start putting it in the piggy bank, right? They're like little kids, like 2-3 years old, right? They start putting it in a little piggy bank, right? That's the thing, because somebody gave them a piggy bank. That's fine. I told them like, hey, you know, that's money sitting there in a piggy bank. It's doing nothing, right? Just, you know, and I was like, what if you give it to somebody and they're going to give you back more money, you know? And it has to be like super basic conversation, and like you kind of get a little more and more detail as they get older. But it has to be super basic, right? That somebody else needs money and could use the money to do something with that, right? And rather than it sitting in your piggy bank. And it made sense. So what I've done is I created this like Google sheet, and every time they have money, they want to put it, instead of putting it in your piggy bank, they put it in our kids' loan account. And it collects interest. So essentially, instead of giving them allowances, they get interest on their money. And I picked an arbitrary number just because it's easy, 1% a month, which is 12% a year.
They're staking their allowance.
They're staking their allowance, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
To use Greg's Web3 analogy. I mean, the thing that I thought was so interesting about it was it's a topic that I often think about of like, we have this complete inability to educate children and young adults on investing money, you know, like modern principles of all of this. And the things that, by the way, like our parents learned about that stuff are not really applicable today. The entire landscape has changed. There's so many different opportunities. There's all this different stuff. So
yeah.
I thought this was really interesting the way you laid it out. It also just made me, made my eyes light up a little bit around business opportunities around it, because as you said in the thread, you're like managing it with kind of a janky spreadsheet that you pulled together, and like, kind of like working with them through that. And it maybe isn't super intuitive to them as they have like tons of technology at their fingertips. And so, you know, I've seen a bunch of like general apps that are doing like kids related investing or different things, but I wonder whether there's an opportunity to kind of create like a very simple set of tools for parents to sort of like engage and have this general discourse and dialogue with their kids around like the range of opportunities. The thing I thought, you know, like you have investing, that's one, like you can put money into the stock market and have discussions around the different companies and the stocks and what it looks like and how it tracks over time. You have like a bank, like this interest idea, which is like you put, you know, yeah, you put money in and it's being loaned out to other people. Here are the other people that got it. Here's what it looks like. You might have you know, the different areas of it, right? Like bonds, whatever it might be. But kind of create a set of like very simple, intuitive technology tools that allow you to have those discussions. Recently saw a company called, Greg, you and I talked about this, Early Bird that I think our friend Alexis backed, that has like the investing side of it, where you can kind of like set up an account for your kid and have, you know, people contribute dollars so that you can have investments and talk to your kid about those over time. I think the combination of like the actual functionality plus the education and like discussion aspect of it is where it becomes really interesting. Like what you're doing, where you're actually able to have the discussions with your kids, explain to them how it works, what the trade-offs are of each decision, etc. That's where I think something really interesting comes together. So I'm curious for your guys' thoughts.
I love it. I mean, I'm actually just checking it out. I haven't heard of Early Bird. There are some other, what's the one with the, something with green? I know one of my kids was asking for like a credit card from that company. It was specifically for children and to help them manage finances, right? So anything around educating about finances for kids, I think it's a great thing. It makes them more comfortable with money. You know, some of the comments I was seeing in the threads, and it was like, it wasn't, largely people loved it, right?
Yeah.
It kind of went a bit viral, relatively speaking for me, you know, not Sahil viral, but it went viral enough for me. You know, there were some comments about, you know, some parents are like, oh, let the kids be kids and don't talk to them about money. Like, I feel like they should be more comfortable about money and not be all weird about it when they grow up. And if you kind of, you know, and it's not like I sit there with them, like just talk about money all the time, but that's, I think that's part of the education.
Yeah. And it's not like you're forcing, I mean, you're giving them the sense of the trade-offs, right? Like they can either sit and let their money grow or they can spend it, in which case it's not growing and they're using it on something. And so like my general take on it is like, this is stuff that you're going to have to decide the rest of your life. Like you, all three of us, every time you have to decide whether to go buy some nice thing or spend it on something else, you're deciding between like investing it in something cool, putting it into the market, staking it in crypto, like doing all of these different things. You're having to make those trade-offs and those decisions. And so why not educate kids on those trade-offs over time from an early age? The challenge with most of these businesses historically, by the way, has been the customer acquisition cost is insanely high because kids are like Gen Z, all of these like teen investing apps and teen banking apps, notoriously very difficult businesses that you have to raise a shitload of money for because the churn is crazy high because the kid just like, you know, they get on it and they're all into it and then they go on to the next thing, like whatever the next hot thing is that comes really high churn. And it's really hard to market to them. Like you're marketing, to our point earlier, through TikTok, Instagram, Snapchat, it's super expensive to buy the ads and to get the customers. So I think the like going early is really interesting because then you're actually selling to a parent. Like with Early Bird, it's kind of cool because they're like selling to me, or they're selling to you, Val, and they're saying like, oh, you're interested in talking to your kid about this over time. Come join us. You're going to be able to track and watch this throughout your life. And so now it's like a sticky customer that is sitting there. I think there's something actually really interesting with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, one of the distributions that I remember when I was researching, one of the categories we were looking into potentially start a business around, and it was actually kind of related to families and children. What I realized, how huge of a distribution channel the schools themselves are, and you could get in them through PTAs.
Oh, B2B2C sale. I like that.
Yeah, the parent teacher associations are like everywhere, like, and they have so many parents involved, and you know, and teachers like. So there are many ways to get into some of these categories.
Here's the tech light version of it, by the way, which I'll leave you and we can jump to the next idea. The tech light, so the tech heavy version is something like Early Bird, you know, build a whole platform, they raise money, they're like, you know, now a high-flying tech company. The tech light version is literally go create like a newsletter or a blog that is kind of offers free information plus like paid premium tools that take parents, new parents on this money and educational journey with their kids. I think that in and of itself would be really interesting and valuable, where you're literally just like, hey, we're going to give you free information about how to talk about interesting new money things and teach them to your kids. And by the way, if you want to do more, here's like the free, or no, here's like the premium paid set of tools for like showing in a spreadsheet how to track the different things. And it's just like a preset spreadsheet where you can track their investments or track the interest stuff. I think that would be really cool. You could probably go set that up and like build an audience around something like that. And I bet you could generate a 7-figure business just off of doing something like that.
Well, listen, MarketWatch, I don't know if we can move on, but like MarketWatch is like the, right? I think it's MarketWatch that has the stock market game.
Yeah.
Right. And if you have kids, like all the schools use that one platform to do a stock market game. Like they compete in the schools and they all use that MarketWatch stock market game. So somebody's already giving, it's just like one tool.
Yeah.
And it's been used for who knows how many years it's been around.
I think it existed when I was in school.
Yeah. Like it's been around, you know, I mean, I went to school, they didn't have MarketWatch back then. So, they used to do it some other like little paper, like I would fill out like my stock buys, I remember, on a piece of paper. But yeah, like those tools, and I bet MarketWatch has so much traffic just coming from that particular category.
If I was doing this idea, I would do it as a free-to-play game. So a video game. Okay. I'm reading this book right now called Reality is Broken, Why Games Make Us Better and How They Could Change the World by Jane McGonnell. And it's fascinating. And I think it's actually a must read for any, I think it's a must read for any person interested in product, but I also think it's a must read for any parent. Because there's definitely that, you know, a lot of parents think, oh my God, you know, my kids are playing video games, it's a waste of time, that sort of thing. But it's just about how you can use game dynamics to get people to learn how to do things. And if it's a free game, you can go to the PTA and be like, hey, like, it's a free game. Go check it out. Go to xyz.com. Get them.
That's what Robinhood is.
Yeah, it's a game.
It's what Robinhood. They gamify the stock market.
Yeah.
Listen, so somebody like probably my age and you guys, right? The reality is the government has pulled away the ability for the average people to make a lot of different kinds of investments. The SEC basically blocks all kinds of different opportunities because they, you know, they scrutinize everything, right? So that's why we have the world we live in where institutional money like VC money has access to all these tech companies, grows them to tens of billions of dollars of value, only then give put them out on the IPO because it's just not worth for these companies to go public anymore, right? Same thing happens with all the alternative investments. And we're starting to see all this cracking all over the place. Robinhood gamified it. I mean, they got into trouble with the SEC a bit here and there, right? You got like all these other platforms that are just made it more available, like AngelList, right? Or other places. Like, so you got more public involved in just all these investments now because it's finally getting like reopened up, and there's just so much pent up demand for that, and so I think we're seeing that right now. And like to your point, Greg, like Robinhood is that's what exactly they did, is they gamified the dynamics of the stock market.
This is like a fascinating space, but I'm actually about Greg. I haven't talked to you about this. I'm about to invest in a big player in this space in India that's doing like I don't know what it's called, like play to game, I don't know, it's like real money finance type games where like you put money into it that gets you like literal tokens, not like crypto tokens,
it's
but
like
literal
crypto play.
Well, it's like being in an arcade, so like you put you know 10 rupees in. Dude. You get 10 rupees worth of tokens, you can use them to play the like games that are in the app, and you can earn rewards from the app, and that's kind of like their marketing costs. But the 10 rupees you put in is actually like into a savings account, like it's invested for you. And so then you can like, it's sort of a way of onboarding this whole new generation of people into saving and investing via games. And so like exactly to your point, Greg, it's this amazing way of like onboarding an entirely new generation of people into saving, investing, etc., through a gamified experience that people kind of intuitively know and understand.
Yeah.
Super interesting space.
Play to earn. I think that's the terminology for all those games.
Yeah,
right?
This isn't quite play to earn.
With savings component.
Yeah. I don't know what the like effective term is of this. It's not play to earn because you're not like It's not quite the same mechanics of it. It's not like a crypto, you know, et cetera. It's really like, you know, real money gaming is kind of like the general space that it exists in, but super interesting space nonetheless. Yeah. Anyway, let's jump. Who else has one?
Business idea. Who did the first last one?
I think that one was me.
Oh yeah, you did the last one. Okay. Listen, man, I could give it a shot.
Go for it.
I think that, and I'm learning this myself now, to be frank, I think debt is underrated, right? I've never used debt in my life, whether aggressively or even moderately. I'm starting to use it moderately. The reason I'm saying that is the abundance of availability of like SBA loans now. The government is like looking for ways to give out money. People should be taking advantage of that, mm-hmm. right? Because, and if you could use that, and I'm not saying like just do stupid shit and waste, you know, and, you know, take on debt. I think it's very serious, but in right moderation, you could acquire a little, you know, or not, maybe not so little to most people, you know, a business, right? That maybe it's a franchise business or it's a, you know, a local, you know, local two doors doing whatever, selling whatever or doing whatever, right? So if you could take an SBA loan, a lot of times the mechanics are you could pay that loan off so quickly, and then you have this high ROI business that will pump out cash flow for you even after you pay that, as you're paying that loan even. So there are so many opportunities around that, especially if the interest rates are being super low. I think that everything becomes an opportunity.
Yeah, I think you know, the combination. So SBA loans, Small Business Administration, like they give out loans. Basically, they have partner banks all around the country. So you can look up on the website what partner banks exist near you. Develop a relationship with like a local branch that issues these loans. They come with really friendly terms. You know, like long terms, low rates. Obviously, rates are rising some now, but still quite low. I think the combination of SBA loans. So the downside of SBA loans is they are personal guarantees yeah. and recourse to you. So if you default on one of these, you're going to be on the hook with like garnishing wages in the future to pay them off. But an SBA loan in combination with doing some form of seller financing, when you go buy a small business, is like a hugely, hugely powerful thing. And it's what some of, if you're on Twitter and you follow like Cody Sanchez, who we've had on this show, or Nick Huber, or some of these other folks, they're writing about this, where it's like this huge opportunity that exists where you can go buy these small businesses with extraordinarily little down. Chris Munn is another one that I've seen write about this. Where basically like you can put $50,000 down, get like $750,000 of seller financing, which is basically that you're buying the business from them, but what are they going to do with that money? They're going to have to pay a bunch of taxes on the business. And so they're loaning you the money to buy their own business, and you're going to pay them a rate on that. So for them, they're happy because A, they don't have to pay taxes because it's not like a gain yet. It's a loan that they're making. And they're getting a rate of return on it, which is probably above what the market is giving them in this environment. And the combination of the seller financing plus an SBA loan, you can go buy a business that maybe is making like several $100,000 in cash a year for much less than that and be making it a massive effective rate of return on the equity that you're putting into it. So, I mean, I agree with you. I think it's really interesting. The flip side of it is I do think there's like massive headaches that operating one of those businesses can have that, you know, small business Twitter maybe like glazes over when they write about these things.
Oh, absolutely. It's anything like that is a hustle, right? But if you are making whatever, if you're making $60,000 salary or $80,000 salary, right? And you have the opportunity to buy something that's generating $200,000. I mean, that's a game changer. And you'll like, if I was in those shoes, I'd probably hustle to make that $200,000. And then eventually at $200,000, you know, you buy a few more or you build a few more and you're up to $500,000, $1 million a year in profits. And like, I don't really follow much of those on Twitter, but like I've never taken an SBA myself, yeah. But some people asked me for advice, and like I'll give you one example. This guy, he has a family, and he was looking at buying a business for $2 million that was generating like $700,000 in profit. I think it was EBITDA or net. I don't remember. And then, you know, and he could take a, he was already approved for SBA to give him a loan. All he had to do is put $100,000 or $130,000, something like along those lines. And there you go. Like you put on $120,000 and you could buy a business that's generating $500,000-$600,000, right? And there's so much cushion. Like even if something goes wrong and you don't make that $600,000 and now you made $400,000 or $300,000, there's just still so much cushion in between for these small businesses because they're typically sold at like three times, you know, 3 to 5 times income. So their ROI and like there's a big cushion. If you mess something up, there is like room to make mistakes.
Yeah. That's kind of like it's interesting too, because it's a way for people to like opt out of the standard path, right? Like maybe you're not, you know, a tech, you know, builder or where you're not going to go raise a bunch of money for some VC backed thing. That's totally fine. But you also don't want to go, you know, have to work for someone the rest of your life. This is like a pretty cool way if you're, you know, entrepreneurial to go buy a local business and build, you know, really meaningful income and wealth, you know, without having to do either of those paths. Like you can kind of opt out of the standardized life and system of like working for someone and climbing up the corporate ladder and buy like a local landscaping business. And you know, yeah, operate
like,
and
it doesn't have to be so scary. Like buying a local landscape business is scary. Like there's so many things that you probably most people don't know about, right? But you could also buy a franchise, right? And a lot of the stuff is already figured out for you by those friends. And it doesn't have to be like a major, major franchise. It could be like a franchise with 300 locations.
I wanted
right?
to do kids swim schools. That was the one that I was like really high on recently. Because parents pay.
Kids swim schools.
Everyone puts their kids into these swim schools now. The like, I was looking it up the other day. The unit economics on the boxes, like they make a couple $1 million per box. With like really high margins because it's literally just a pool. Like it's not a fancy place. And so if you can just like finance the build out of one of these, very low overhead from a labor perspective because it's literally just like a few classes a day and you just need like one or two teachers to do them. But there are these kids swim schools that you can go get. There's not like crazy net worth requirements to getting the franchise licenses or whatever it's called for given territories.
I think I know you exactly which one you're talking about because my kids for many years used to go to one of those and yeah. There's also a franchise.
Yeah, and literally everyone puts their kids into these things. Goldfish was the one that I was looking at.
I'm not sure if it's a franchise or not. I think it is a franchise called yeah. Safety Swim.
Yeah, yeah. The other one that would be amazing would be building these like kids like birthday party places. These things have like risen, especially in higher income areas. Like
bounce
people,
you order
yeah, they're like you basically just put up like a turf field and like a bunch of like games, and people can like bring their own food. You rent out the place; they're rented out for like years. The one in my friend's neighborhood where he was having his kid's birthday party is literally rented out every weekend for the next year. Like he had to do the kid's third birthday at the same time as doing his second birthday because it's rented out for every weekend. So, and I was just like, this is in the middle of nowhere. It's in an industrial area. It's literally just like turf. There's nothing super
those,
nice
those
about it.
Those things are a machine too. Like they, oh. Like they have everybody on a conveyor belt to go from room to room.
Yeah. And you can do like during the week, you can do like corporate events or you could do like soccer games, like do like a league or something like that. I think you could make a killing off that business.
I'm listening yeah. to you guys speak and I couldn't be less interested in like owning a landscape business or owning this like turf where I'm inviting kids to it and for high income earners. Like I think what happened was on Twitter there was everyone just talking about internet products all the time, and then there became this like wave of like, you know, sort of physical sweaty businesses. And it's been like really, you know, on vogue to like go and buy a laundromat. And my take is it's a really personal decision. Like I know as an yeah. internet person, like owning a laundromat, owning a landscaping business, like, you know, my hair looks good or, you know, I've got a lot of hair, but my hair is about to be gone, like fully
yeah,
taken out of my
stressful.
Hair. Like if I go and, you know, run a business like that, I think that it's a very personal decision for me. No bueno, but I think there's going to be a lot. Here's my prediction. I think there's going to be a lot of internet people who are going to end up buying laundromats and stuff like that, and it's going to go really wrong. And I have one more. I want to end with one thing. Val, if you were building your affiliate business and all of a sudden you're like, you know what? I need to go. There's this like loan I can get and I can go like buy a landscaping business. Isn't that like, right before you came on, we were talking about focusing and how being heads down is really important. Isn't that like the opposite of that, like splitting your attention? Like, don't you think like if you're really good at something, don't you think you should like double down on it?
Oh yeah, absolutely. That's what I was saying. Like, figure out what you're good at. Try to do some arbitrage around that and then double down into that category. I would absolutely not be buying landscaping businesses. You know, like I said, I don't know anything about a lot of things out there.
But what, so my pushback to this, Greg, by the way, first off, I completely agree with you. Not for everyone. Sounds like a complete headache. The way I would do it, because I don't want to go run a landscaping business either. I don't want to run like this place was called Chatter Splatter, like the kids' turf thing, or like a goldfish swim school. Like, I don't want to go run that shit either. And I don't think I'd be good at it. But could I like go pay some young person like 200 grand a year, and it would be a great salary for them to run it and like deal with all of the headaches, give them like some upside plus a salary. And now I own something that happens to be netting me like 40% cash on cash returns annually. And now it's just like a great investment and it's throwing off a bunch of cash flow. I don't hate that idea.
Yeah. Until that idea works extremely well until something happens and the manager quits or leaves, and all of a sudden you're like on the front lines in the trenches, and like you're sacrificing your main business to go for a swim.
Yeah.
And that's the risk. And yeah, like, is that, you know, a small risk? Absolutely. But like, the way I think about it is like, I want to take risks in my world and my business, like around like agency and studio and stuff like that. Like, in internet stuff and community and Web3, I don't want to take risks in stuff like that.
I think what you're getting at like a very profound and important point to reiterate, which is like, know your game and focus on your game. I think it's a great point to make, because I've been saying this recently, like if you want to excel in anything, write down the 10 most important things in your life and then cross 7 of them off the list and focus on those 3, because like you can't have 10 things that you care about and that you're focusing on. You can really only have a couple. And so you need to just be ruthless about prioritizing them. I completely agree with you, Greg, actually, in hearing you say it and thinking about it, because I've often thought about this in the case of real estate, where I've had friends who are like, make some decent money, and then they're like, oh, I'm gonna go buy rental properties. And personally, I think that most people that buy rental properties, maybe this is a hot take, it's like a vanity thing where they want to be able to flex and say that they own rental properties. Because the vast majority of my friends that have done that, it is the combination of a headache, and it doesn't drive better returns than just investing in a publicly traded REIT that would get you the same exposure to real estate in general without having to actually manage any properties or do it. So I agree with you, Greg. Like, I think there's probably, for the vast majority of situations, a much lower headache and lower intensity version of driving the exact same financial returns.
You got to be able to, if you can't scale something, it's not going to be, to Greg's point, it's not going to be manageable, because like that manager quits, everything goes to, hits the fan, right? I actually have a portfolio of multiple companies, right, that either co-founders of mine or managers who are CEOs of these businesses. So like, I'm talking about serious companies. Like, I have a mobile advertising business. My co-founder is the CEO. He runs it. You know, there are 100, we have 100 employees. It's on the track to do like 100 million revenue, very profitable, right? He got it. Like, I don't get involved. Like, real estate, I partnered up with a guy who I've known many, many years. He's like super smart. I started this business 5 years ago, real estate development around, like around New York City area is where our focus is, which, by the way, everybody wrote off all over the country, like every headline, like everybody's writing off New York City, but it's doing so well. It's unbelievable. Like, we got over 100 million worth of properties that we're either already finished developing or sold or you know, kind of starting to break ground on now. So I think it's very doable as long as you have the right managers in place. But you have to scale up the team first, because if that manager can't can't continue for whatever reason, right? If they get hit by a bus or something, you got to have ability to be, you know, if you have scale, there are always people that could, step into those shoes, or you could hire into that position because, you know, you have a big business that could afford a solid manager. So luckily I've never had that situation, but I think it's very, very doable. Again, on the bigger side, you shouldn't be doing a landscaping business on the side, like, and hoping that somebody's going to run that business for you. It's just not going to happen.
Yeah. Normally if something sounds too good to be true, it probably is. And I think with most of these things, you need to go in eyes wide open about that. Like, you're not getting those kind of returns, for free. It comes with additional risk in the form of headaches or financial risk.
You're buying a job too. You're like at that scale, you're buying a job.
Yeah. Which, like, if you're, you know, a hustler and a grinder and you want to get out of your like sales role that you were doing and trying to climb the corporate ladder, maybe that's what you want. And maybe it's like a great way to kind of own your own career and own your life, and you can go build around that. But to Greg's point, not for everybody. This was awesome. And really enjoyed getting to jam with you, man. I mean, $30 million from a parent's basement, I think, has to go down in the record books as one of the more legendary stories of hustling that we've had on the show. So, dude, truly appreciate you joining. Bunch of interesting stuff. I mean, the huge opportunity around finance for kids. Check out Early Bird if you haven't checked it out, Val. I think it's pretty interesting. I just set one up for my kid, actually. Super smart move by the founders, by the way. Like, I had tweeted about something with it, and they sent me $50 for my kid's account, and it like got it started. Now I'm like, oh, I'm using this. You know, it is a great customer acquisition tactic.
No, you're talking about it.
To do that, really smart. Now I'm talking about it, and they did it. So very, very smart. Between that, the business idea around, you know, or lack thereof, of some of these sweaty businesses, as Greg points out, the downsides of them. A lot of interesting stuff to chew on here. So really appreciate you joining. Any final takeaways from either of you guys?
Go read.
No, man, I appreciate you having me. This is awesome. I mean, listen, I don't know what you guys are doing, but you got some magic sauce, both of you, on kind of the content side, and some of the stuff I read, some of the threads I've seen, it's like, wow. It's interesting reading those, because I'm not a good communicator. Some people are and some people aren't. That's just not my strength. And some of the tweets, like, I see coming out of you guys.
I think you're doing pretty well, man.
Yeah, like, I've been doing that and I don't even realize I've been doing that my whole life. You know what I mean?
You're doing pretty well for yourself, man. I don't know. I mean, you're sharing real earned insights because of stuff that you've done and built along the way, which I find really cool, and super value add to the community, because a lot of people can learn from it, both the positives and the negatives along the way. So truly appreciate all that you're doing, and excited to get to continue to follow along on your journey.
Nice meeting you, man. Val. And go read Reality is Broken, Val, that book around game design.
Oh, yeah, that sounds cool. Yeah, we're going to check that out.
Yeah, absolutely. And I already got the kids thing here, so I'm probably signing up to that too.
Yeah, check it out. Awesome. Awesome. Great seeing you, man. Thank you so much. Thanks so much for listening to today's episode. If you have any questions that you want featured in a future episode, email us at hi@trwih.com. Leave us a review at Apple or Spotify to help us grow the reach of this podcast. Until next time, we will see you soon. Joy, cause they just want you in that same old predicament. Misery, love a company, think on it, pray on it, sip a cup of tea, never let the world be broken in the borders.